Hello, everybody. Mark Carlson here, SNEA Technical Council Chair. Welcome to the STC Podcast. Every week, the STC Podcast presents important technical topics to the developer community. Each episode is hand-selected by the SNEA Technical Council from the presentations at our annual Storage Developer Conference. The link to the slides is available in the show notes at snea.org/podcast. You are listening to STC Podcast Episode 31. Today we hear from Peter Murray, Principal System Engineer with Virtual Instruments, as he presents Data Center Workload Analysis from the 2016 Storage Developer Conference.
My name is Peter Murray. Welcome. Are we time yet? Close enough? Okay. Hi. Thanks for coming, especially on a Sunday. I'm going to talk to you today. I should take a minute and say who I am. I'm principal systems engineer for a company called Virtual Instruments. And you're doing, if you're a storage developer, you probably never heard of that company. You might have heard of a company called Load Dynamics. Recently, Load Dynamics and Virtual Instruments merged together. Virtual Instruments does data center modeling today primarily for Fibre Channel. File is coming in future. Load Dynamics has been doing performance testing for a little over 8 years now. We started doing File, SMB, and NFS. We've grown from them to do Fibre Channel, iSCSI, Object. Well, Object, the only thing we really have to do is redefine our results. Is it a bucket or is it an object? Is it things like that? It's still all HTTP. So we've been doing this for quite a while now. And we have an extremely high-performance system that does close to line rate with a rich protocol implementation for iSCSI and Fibre Channel. We have the SCSI commands, of course, for SMB and NFS. We have the regular commands plus the metadata commands. We have for object, it's get or set, get or put, right? So we just, the way we describe them changes a bit. One thing we've learned, especially over the last few years, is that your applications don't look like the testing tools. So I want to try to describe some of those differences, why it's important to understand why you should be considering testing using as close modeling as closely to an application as you can. So how do we test all solid state or storage arrays? Well, that's actually, solid state storage arrays are an interim product. We're coming up on NVMe and it's going to happen quickly. We're still going to have to understand and characterize how the applications run regardless of what's happening in the network. We're still going to have to monitor them to understand how to configure them and keep them all running as well as we can. So I'm going to talk about the different approaches there are for assessing storage, the traditional ways and the more modern way. How to select the best methodology. How should you test these applications? So we'll discuss that. And to help you to discover, this is actually mostly for the enterprise community, how to size an array, how much to purchase for a given application or combination of applications. Increasingly with Flash, where you would have a stand that would be maybe four racks for Oracle, that's maybe collapsed down into half a rack now, and there's still headroom left over to do more work. So people are talking now about consolidating multiple applications onto a single array. Okay. So this is my assertion of the whole thing. The best way to test an all solid state array is to emulate real applications. I'll go into why that is. We want to understand the temporal locality, which is when data is written, and the spatial locality, where it is written. Those things tend to have characteristics that go along with specific applications. For example, a redo log has a lot of writes going to it. A web site, a web server is serving data often. Now, the selfies go up there and it's the place, the data center is where the selfie goes to die, they say. Write once, read never in many cases. But listening to music, other applications is very, very read intensive. And there tends to be patterns about where data is read and written that are predictable, that can be used to help construct a test that tells you how an array is going to work in a real environment. We also have data content. One of the things that's happened a lot now with especially with all flash arrays, is people are doing deduplication and they're doing compression. We didn't used to do that on disk-based arrays so much. Dedupe was used, it was done post-ingest. There'd be another application that would go and find multiple copies of the same data and say, okay, it's all here. Compression largely was ignored before the advent of the solid-state array because it was too darn slow to go out, get that data back, decompress it, and send it back to the user, added huge amounts of latency. So it just wasn't done. But now it's table stakes in a lot of cases. It's just the way the array works, you can't shut it off. Data content patterns are also important. So if you're doing deduplication and compression, the data is either random or it's compressible. You know, a storage array doesn't know that it's a Word file. It doesn't know that things are repeated, but it can watch the data stream and find blocks that match up and store them only once. And they can find blocks of data that are compressible, smash them down. And in fact, the way a lot of this happens, they'll do a block comes in, they do a checksum on that block. They look to see if they know that checksum. If so, they make a reference to it. If not, they check to see, is it all repeating characters? If that's the case, you make a metadata reference, nothing hits the back end. If it's compressible, they'll take that, smash that data down as much as they can, and store it. Now, some vendors do this better than others. Some vendors do this all in stream. Some of it do combination of ingest, and some of them do it post-ingest. Can have an effect on your performance, can have effect on how well that application runs. And the last and one thing I consider is extremely important is bursts. Computers don't send nice metered packets across the network. They don't send it 100 IOPS. They don't send it 1,000 IOPS. They unload what they need to unload as quickly as they can and move on to the next thing. And this can create, and does create in most cases, sub-second bursts of activity. And when you test with traditional storage tools where you ask for 100 IOPS, okay, it'll take that 100 IOPS, it'll cram down in over that 1 second, it'll very evenly send those. Well, that's not how an application works. That's not how a client works. The client, as I said, gets rid of that data as quickly as it can and moves on to the next. And this can have a significant effect on performance. In fact, Tuesday night, if you can make it at 7 o'clock, we're holding a birds of a feather session to talk about this specifically. We have customers who sometimes come back to us and say that our testing is invalid because they get better performance from VD Bench or Iometer or something like that than they get from our app. And in fact, we say, yeah, that's accurate. And it's because it's the nature of how that application interacts with the storage array. So bursts are there, virtually every time. Okay, so we got here through primarily the first program everybody knows about, Iometer. Intel wrote it to test a disk drive. They then stretched it out and said we could use it to test a network drive. And then multiple network drives. And you can pick an IOPS rate. You can pick a throughput rate. And you test either with all random or open data, essentially. Nothing. Well, it depends on the protocol you're working with. For example, if you send all zeros to a Microsoft file server, it doesn't store anything. You do a read back and it says, I want 64K. It says, okay, you got your 64K. Bytes read, zero. And goes on to the next one. If there's something actually there that it retrieves, it will retrieve it for you. These programs didn't represent any kind of an application. They don't emulate spatial or temporal locality. You say, I want 100 IOPS on this LUN or this region of a LUN or this file system. It does it. There's nothing about how applications work, where you tend to have hotspots. Again, I'll go back to the example of an Oracle workload. If you're working, you tend to write consistently in small areas of a LUN, and that drifts over time through the workday or over a period of time. And it changes according to your app. If your app is just all real-time work, then you'll have one pattern. If you have an application that comes back at the end of the month, an example might be for smart readers. Every day they're taking just a little bit of data, and that's being thrown into the array. At the end of the month, they go back and troll all that data spread over time and mixed on the array. You don't really know where it is on the array because the arrays abstract the physical location from the logical location. You say you're writing to LUN 2 on some particular array on some particular target. You don't know where that data goes. It may be spreading them across a lot of different LUNs to do wear leveling, to make sure that flash lasts a long time. They don't just do it where you tell them to. That was a big problem with early flash. They said, store it. They stored it. And I worked with a bank customer quite a while ago that their flash storage would burn out about every year. It's because there was no wear leveling and you have a limited amount of write cycles. In fact, I'm going to get to that. So they didn't emulate data content. They didn't burst. You couldn't emulate the varying loads on the different LUNs, which are very significant. An Oracle application. Has anybody seen the Oracle application? Don't nod. The Oracle application does not exist. Everyone's different. It depends on what's being implemented, what it's being used for, how it's often is accessed. Often they're doing data mining, other types of applications. They run through that data in different ways. And literally, everyone is different. So anytime when you say, okay, here's the Oracle workload, if you get a benchmark that says that, it's a kind of an approximation of sort of one or more companies that are averaged out to kind of look like what an Oracle workload looks like. It's better than nothing, certainly, but it doesn't really represent how an individual enterprise's application works. So configuring metadata, configuring the data structures, all that takes some complex work, and these products didn't tend to do it. I've already said spatial and temporal locality are a fact. These are the way applications work. They're designed this way, especially. They're designed to optimize that as much as possible. The data that's coming into an array oftentimes can be reduced. Okay, we're not going to compress video. There's other things, astronomical data you're probably not going to compress, but there are tons of data types that can be reduced and deduplicated. All of these content types are present. It's a fact of life in a daily operation of an application. Some of these arrays can't be tested without locality or content because you don't turn it off. It's always there. And if you just run zeros out to an array and test, nothing actually goes to disk. Well, disks, SSD. All that gets updated is the metadata. And it's just, oh yeah, X number of bytes of zero, X number of bytes of repeating able or something like that, or maybe a 2-byte pair, depends on the implementation. But nothing really gets to the back end. So testing with that doesn't tell you really anything about how that array is going to work in production. And data is sent in bursts, as I already said. It's there. It's not a problem. It's a fact of life. So, as you know, we haven't gotten much better disk drive performance in a long time. Okay, we're putting nitrogen in drives. Okay, they're getting bigger and bigger, but we eventually run into the problem of access. If you've got one controller and one path into that drive, the more users and the more requests you add, you will hit the choke point of that drive. At a very low rate. Now with SSDs, it gets better because they respond so much more quickly, but we run ultimately into the same problem of ultimately with one interface, you're going to get so much throughput from that drive. That's another reason that a lot of these companies abstract the back end. You think you're writing to a file, well, you don't know, you're splattering all over the back end. And they know if you're reading back and something's pending, rather than wait, they can go to the metadata, grab that information about that block, reconstruct it, and send it to you faster than it would take to wait for that read to complete. So processors got better, networks, architectures, 100 gig, it's coming and things are going to get even faster and faster and faster. Well, as long as we can survive the radiation, that is. Short stroking, only using part of a drive so you wouldn't let the read and write heads move as much, was a way to get better work. And there are people who have spent their lives working with that art. It's not just a tech thing. It's something you learn over time, how a drive, a particular brand or particular type of drive performs, and they learned how to short stroke them to make them work better. And as I said, you couldn't do data reduction because it made things too slow. Solid state is a lot different. They say reading is free. Doesn't matter, reading from a solid state array doesn't cause any damage, it's fast. There may be issues if you're trying to get a block, an adjacent block to a block that is being written. I'll talk about that more in just a moment. And it is largely unaffected by data location. Now, writes are different. They typically are a little bit slower. That was one of the things that we found when we went to solid state arrays. They read like blazes, but they don't always write that quickly. So the writing is often performed at a page memory page level, which consists of a series of blocks. The inserting data or appending it can cause what we call write amplification, because you can no longer write to an address space in a block. In a lot of cases, you don't even write to a block, you write to a memory page. So they aggregate data and then they rewrite it. And to make these changes can often, you've changed one place, oh, it's going to have an effect on a different block, it's going to have an effect on a different block, and they have to rewrite multiple times just to get that data written back down, especially when you're doing appends and overwrites, things like that. So, I've heard this multiple times from my friends and the vendors. The modern solid state array is a write avoidance device. They hate writing. And people have come up with all kinds of techniques for doing this. You keep RAM that's oftentimes capacitor backed up so that if everything goes to heck and the thing falls on its face, it can come back up and take off where it was. None of that stuff that they're writing there even gets to the SSDs until you each achieve a certain amount of writing or over a period of time where they can coalesce multiple blocks into a page and write that back down. Many arrays don't overwrite at all. In fact, they just append to what was already there and what was there and what was there and what was there. And they keep a track of what's going on in each block. And when all of the references to that block have been deleted or removed, you know, we're not using that block anymore, well, there may be referred to in multiple places, but they'll wait till it gets down to that last one, and then they go back and reclaim that memory space. That's what we call garbage collection, because you're not just overwriting a chunk of data. You're inside of a block. You're overwriting multiple blocks. Okay. flash write access time is very much implementation dependent. Some all-flash arrays can write, accept writes at very high rates. Some not so much. But when I say not so much, that may be dependent upon what that vendor wants. What do they care about? Are they trying to emulate a modern application, or are they trying to emulate blazing fast performance? IOPS numbers, to me, from the vendor, are a very, very loose guideline. They're not related to your applications. They're not related to anything but a very strict test that is run with very predictable patterns. Okay. As I said earlier, data reduction may require you to do post-processing. You may have to go back after the fact because data is coming in so fast that there's not time to do all of the dedupe and compression. So what happens is when the traffic slows down, the controller senses that and uses some of its cycles then to reclaim that data, smash it down, reduce the size of it. And I've seen this happen where we're testing with a vendor. We go up and we write literally all day. And we come back, this is early on, we came back the next morning, we'd gotten it up to 90% the day before and it was down to 40% the next day because it had the time to do that data reduction at night. In fact, this is one of the interesting things about the Emerald test that's being used for energy storage. You can get a Energy Star rating for your storage array now. We still got to consider in that case what happens after the test is complete, because oftentimes that CPU keeps right on going, essentially at maximum, deduplicating and compressing data. And that can take hours, it can take more than a day, depending on how much data was written to it and how large the data set is. Let's see, did I already? Yeah. With some of these arrays, if you just keep writing and writing and writing and writing, they will have performance degradation over time. It becomes very hard to do garbage collection if data is being overwritten constantly and very fast. And in some cases, that's a bug. In some cases, that's the way they designed that array. They want to sell and size it appropriately for what it's going to be used for. So, in isolation, it's hard, and the IOPS numbers don't tell you what you really need to know. Bursty writes are inherent to all application traffic. All traffic, as I've said, is sent in bursts. Client sends at full rate. This happens whether it's a busy period or a quiet period. And you can say, oh, we can sustain 100,000 IOPS. Well, within a second, those micro bursts can exceed that rate and then drop down below. If I've got an 8K file to send, as a client, I'm not going to spread that out over a second. Boom, it's gone. And you add that with multiple clients, and you get these micro peaks. Okay. Quiet times and busy periods, yeah. So this is the problem with most of the test tools out today. VDBench, I know, is the one exception where you can turn on burstiness. But I have yet to see a vendor test that does. Instead, they send metered traffic. You want 100 IOPS, you want 3,000 IOPS, they'll take that time period, they'll cut it down, and they'll send those in a very predictable pattern. You can add in multiple clients to run against it, but those patterns remain the same. It can be a challenge also to emulate these hotspots I mentioned that are areas of high writing and the drift of those hotspots over time. All of us have struggled with ways to implement testing tools that do that effectively. If you're testing that way, you're not demonstrating how a storage array is going to work in production. You're just not. This is what you get out of this is vendor numbers. You really shouldn't use this to evaluate a storage array. I've added this URL here. This is, if you go to the Virtual Instruments website, there's a pointer to a white paper that describes this. We're going to talk about it Tuesday night. We'll hand out more copies of the white paper. If you've got the time, please come, because I think this is something that's pretty important and is a little bit controversial right now. So how else is flash different? Your addressable space is often way less than your raw space. Sometimes it's 1.5, sometimes 2x is the raw space on the array. So you go, I've got a terabyte available on this array. I write a terabyte and I keep writing. Well, there's no more address space, so I'm technically going to be overwriting that previous space. But in the back end, they're using this extra space to fill that up to give them the chance to go back and do the garbage collection on the areas that have already been written. If you're writing to another location, you sequentially write through a series of blocks, it then is going to be talking to another part of the array so that they can go in and do the garbage collection so that when you come back around the next time, they're still writing just as quickly. Okay, it's certainly an approach. Some vendors use a small amount of actual space. Don't use a whole lot of extra. It depends on the implementation, and it does have an effect on how they perform. By doing this with making addressable storage space larger, raw space larger, it is going to help to increase flash life, just as wear leveling is done. And in many cases now, wear leveling is done at the drive level. And there's still discussions about what's better. Do you do it at the array level or at the drive level? And different vendors have different opinions. You want to see how they perform, you really have to test. Dedupe and compression do decrease performance. It's a fact of life. Over time, if you keep on writing and writing and writing, you will see a reduction in performance while that array is trying to keep up with the deduplication and compression. And fortunately, applications don't tend to go blasting along for days at a time or hours at a time even. There are gaps. This is a temporal and spatial locality. This is where the variation in the load over time. And as the load reduces in terms of writing, they're able to go back and do this housekeeping that cleans things up and reduces the size of the data. Another way, metadata processing can make it harder to fill an array because there's time, depending on the dedupe size. The dedupe unit can be, I've seen, anywhere from about 512K to 512 bytes to 8K or 16K. 8K is very common these days. But the smaller the unit you use for deduplication, the more likely it is that you'll find a repeating pattern. That repeating pattern may be a completely different application, a completely different LUN. It just means that for that extent of that block, it was seen twice. So the smaller block size potentially leads to better dedupe and better compression, but at the cost of that smaller block size making it harder to be able to keep up with high loads as they're coming into an array. Okay, so as I said, hotspots are important. Software services and protocols. We're now at the point where some arrays will do a snapshot or a clone, and all they do is they copy the metadata to a new location and then move on with that clone. That old data, all the data on the back end, which has been all abstracted, is still there and essentially unaffected. Depends on which snapshot you're looking at where the new data gets written. Okay, I had to put this in here because marketing made me. Vendor marketing, people do good marketing. They do their best to present themselves put their best foot forward. Vendors, though, also endorse performance testing. We find a lot of times shameless promotion, but we go out and we do proof of concepts, we do services testing for people all the time. Every week we've got stuff going on. And it's mostly for enterprise customers. They bring us in to say, okay, we've got, I've got an Oracle app, I've got a Exchange app, I've got something like that. We want to know how this is going to work. I've got an HTTP app and I want to put it in two different locations. What if my data center goes down? How long will it take for the recovery to get me back online and get things working? So we're doing this all the time. We're testing vendors one against another. The vendors also like this. They know how they work. They know where their sweet spots are. And so they will oftentimes size their array based upon that, and they'll go after customers based upon different applications. Some just say, all comers, take it on, we're the best at everything, and trust us, and it'll be great. Okay, you're relying on a vendor. I think it's important to understand that, let's hope I don't feedback. I need this to keep me on track. We go out and test and make sure. Will this application run on the proposed array? Who does it best? How big does it have to be? Many vendors are under SLAs. A lot of companies don't buy storage. They lease it. They keep it for 3 years or 5 years. And during that time, they give a service level agreement that says you'll get this much performance out of it, it won't go down, it has all these metrics, this much uptime. So in many cases, those vendors go out and they sell, they over-provision by as much as 40%. In fact, the average is about 40%. That means in the life of that array, you're never going to touch, ever, 40% of the capacity of that array. Others will give you a projected rate from, if you're doing a clustered type of application, they'll say, okay, one node will give you this, two nodes will give you this, and they just multiply it out. And we have customers where one customer I know of started out, they said, well, it's going to be split into five separate buys. So it started with two, it was getting close to full, they added the third one, they added the fourth one, they added the fifth one and the data center went down. And this was pretty public. And it's because it hadn't really been tested to scale. So both ways can bite you. You can waste money by buying too much. You can get hurt by not testing to full capacity. Oh, and vendor benchmarks are benchmarks. They're an average example of something that was created based upon the best efforts of smart people to give you some idea about sizing. They're actually really useful for vendors because you can look at one revision of code to another, one revision of hardware to another, and do a regression. Does it perform as well as before? How much more does it give me? Is there any backsliding on anything? So it's very valuable for that purpose. But if you're testing for something that you're going to put in a real network to run real applications on, it doesn't look like your applications, period. Okay, so if we're going to do performance testing, what do we want to know? So what's the best technology? Should I use all solid state, all flash today, NVMe coming in the future? Should I use a hyper-converged array? Some of those have they have blazing performance, but they don't scale up high enough for the big data center workloads. Hybrid arrays. So if I use disk and flash mixed together, how's it going to work? Totally depends on the application. That smart meter example I used a little while ago, it's writing a little bit of data each day, and that hot data is in flash. But over time, that's going to be demoted down to a disk. And at the end of the month, when it comes time to do billing, you're now stuck with all that data on a disk. Now, they might try to promote as fast as they can to get it up, but a 5% cache miss doubles response time. It's physics. So there can be a huge effect on an application depending on what you're doing and when you're doing it. So hybrid, all disk, private and public cloud, you know, all disk, people are still using it for backups and they'll likely use that for a long time. My goodness, now we have 70-year tape that's still being used. Heaven help you if you try to restore something from 20 years ago. You got to try to find the restore application that'll even work and hope that that data is all clean. But because of laws and rules, people have to do this. So we also want to know which is the best vendor or product for a specific requirement. I got my requirements for my data center. What's the best product to buy? What's the optimal configuration after I decide that that gives me the performance? What I'm going to use in terms of how I chop up that data in logical views? What will I use for fiber channel, for queue depth? What will I use? How many nodes do I need if I'm working with a file-based implementation? All of those are important to understand after you select a specific array is being selected or recommended. So when deduplication, compression, snapshots, clones, replication, anything else, if they're turned on, what's it do to performance? You won't know unless you test with those, with the capabilities that let you do that. What are the limits of a particular config, as I said? So it's not important only to know how it's going to run today. You expect you're going to be using something for 3 to 5 years. What do you expect growth to be? What's the high end of that expectation? And is that system still going to keep operating to that high end? The example I used a few minutes ago, they went to the fifth buy and the whole data center went down because the application, literally, the storage array fell apart. You want to know if array performance degrades over time. It's interesting that we were talking a few years ago all the time about the write cliff, the point that happens with every array. When you write to it long enough and garbage collection kicks in and performance starts to tank. You know, some arrays today, there is no write cliff. You can just keep going and going and going. And because the data is abstracted on the back end, performance stays high consistently. They're able to do the garbage collection so rapidly and so and in the background where you don't need it, because they know, oh, I haven't read from this if I haven't read from something in 10 days, I'm not likely to read from it again. So that's more eligible for getting discarded. Now, it does depend, as I said, on that dedupe size and the compression size. Although we will decrease the size of stuff, they typically don't make those memory pages open again and available again until there's no more requests for that data at all. Okay, so we've had traditional approaches, limits finding, functional testing, error injection, soak testing, blasting something to see if it'll work, and that's typically done right before you go into production. So there's two core methodologies I want to talk about here. Performance profiling, I'll talk about first. This is primarily actually for vendors. Now, there are enterprise use cases as well, but it's primarily for the vendors to understand their own arrays. The second is workload modeling, and that's getting an example of an actual workload in one of a couple ways that you then can replay on a proposed array or a proposed upgrade or something like that and understand how it works. So performance profiling. We want to know how, I don't like using workload here because it tends not to be a workload. It tends to be, I want to know what's my sweet spot on block size? 2K, 4K, 8K, 16K, whatever. What is that sweet spot? What's my optimum queue depth for fiber channel? And that's another black art, finding out what the best number of outstanding commands per network node should be. And you also want to understand at the initiator or the target as well, the number of outstanding commands it can send. So you may request, you may write an 8K file, you might write a 64K file and you're using a block size of 4K. Well, if you have a outstanding command count of 8, that means you're going to essentially do 8 packets 4K, 32K without waiting for a response. As each response comes back in, the array will issue another, or the client will issue another command to get that file across. This keeps more commands in flight. It's a really important with high latency connections, but it's also important in a data center. Problem is, you go too high, performance tanks. You go too low, you're wasting performance. So finding that is important. We call this four corners testing or limits testing. Vendors do these tests. They've got to do them. But remember that the applications don't lack like the performance profiles, and this can be really difficult even with the free tools because it takes a lot of configuration. Most of the free tools require that you do scripting, and it can be a daunting task to get something that's complex enough to represent even a steady state version of an application. As I said, there's some exemptions here or exceptions. Block size, you might want to understand what it does so you can tune an application, but most of the time those applications have been tuned for you already. Client protocols take care of that already. NFS, SMB, all of those. iSCSI, it's the app that does it, or Linux, Unix, that does it for you. It's not something that you typically tune yourself, but it's important to understand how those work. Queue depth can be very important to understand, but that's mostly when you're configuring the network itself. Outstanding commands, as I said. So here's an example of something that we do. More shameless promotion, forgive me for this one, but you can set up, you can see here it's a single screen, there we go, and in this we're setting an access pattern, an IO size, transmit queue depth, the load we want to estimate, and the data reduction that we're going to use here, so uncompressed to compressed. And what this does in our application is you set this up probably 30 seconds to a minute. It doesn't take much time at all. And then you start the test and you walk away, and sometimes a day later, sometimes 3 days later, you come back and it's tested every possible combination that you've listed, and it will then allow you to sort on key performance indicators like IOPS throughput, latency, to see which of those combinations gave the best performance. Performance profiling here as well, those iterations, here's where we show each of those individual tests. So you see 4K, 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 that went to 8 eventually. The queue depth sizes, the load values, and the data reduction. So each of those give values back, and then you can look at the key performance indicators to see what did best. There's some limited value for enterprises, especially the larger ones, banks, insurance, financial, do a lot of tuning, so they tend to want to see this kind of data. For your average application, there's not a lot you get out of this. Queue depth is useful. Outstanding commands can be useful. So that's performance profiling. That's traditionally what we've done. And even that can be very difficult. I made the comment about scripting. We go to customer after customer that says, we don't test. It takes too long to set these tests up. And they're right. It can be very painful. And you talk about doing a test, it's a complex application test. There's probably 1,000 people in the world that could possibly do that. And even with that case, it can take months to set up a test like that. So workload modeling, by contrast, is using stressing an array in the same way or as close to the same way as an application will. So for the IT customers, you can get this information from your current environment. You can either get it from the reporting tools for your array. Just about everybody will produce a CSV file that'll tell you part or most of what happened over a period. How much reading, how much writing, how much of it was random, how much sequential, how large the IOs were, information like that. And the best ones record it at smaller rates. You want the finest grain collection of this that you can get. 5-minute interval is better than a day interval. interval, but an awful lot can happen during 5 minutes. There could have been bursts and spikes that cause the array a whole lot of problem during that time, and you may never see them because they get lost in the noise of the averaging. For the vendors, a lot of our vendor customers do what they call dog food. When they've got a new product out, it goes into their data center. They use that product and they can get information about that. Maybe they're doing their own Oracle workload. Maybe they're doing their own build farm or things like that, and they can get stats about that. What those typically come out as from the vendors as a CSV file, a single CSV file. I'll show you in just a moment. This is a better way to test. It's going to give you a lot better example of what's going to happen on a good day, a bad day, or when there's partial failures, things like that. Oh, and I will say here, packet traces. A packet trace, especially on a 10 gig network, takes an enormous amount of space. It provides you very little data because the amount that you can collect is typically very short. You should be using a specialized analyzer or something if you're collecting the information that way. And you end up with a lot of times that information is useless. If that PCAP refers to a file handle, where you don't know what that file handle is because you weren't, the PCAP doesn't tell you when that file was accessed, the lookup happened on it, you may be never able to correlate back to that. Another issue with them is that if there was no writing to a location, if the PCAP is mostly reading, there's no there there. No, there's nothing to go back and use for testing. Okay, so workload modeling, as I said. Oh, what am I doing here? Let's keep moving forward. Okay, so an example of what you can get doing workload modeling, you can compare one server to another. You can compare different application types to another. And you can do that with a single consistent test across those multiple arrays. This comes from, we've been asked for years from the beginning, well, can you tell me what my Oracle workload looks like? What's my Exchange workload look like? And early on, we had to say, we don't know. Everyone's different. And we've put in an enormous amount of work to be able to derive this information. They want to understand when they're upgrading. They want to understand when they're changing configs. They want to test for vendors. They get a problem from a user. If they can get that stats file, they can pull it in, and they can then rerun that and see what that does to their array. We can find realistic limits to an application by taking a particular workload and amplifying it. And when I say workload, they oftentimes end up being combined. There's the day-to-day average workload. Then you can add in the backups. You can add in the boot storm in the morning. You can add in the end-of-month processing. You can add in the end-of-quarter processing and do these as aggregates and run them together to see how that array performs in those different conditions. Okay. We've found a new way to do this. It's done in the cloud. I'm going to display a URL that is free and widely available today. We will eventually make this more extensive and probably start charging for it. But I think it's something that can be useful for you. Okay, we call this Workload Central, workloadcentral.com. Any of you can go out to workloadcentral.com, request membership. We will send it, grant you that. And from that, you can take those CSV files, as I mentioned, upload them to Workload Central, and get information about them. There's also a workload library. There's some educational stuff on there that's useful as well. So what we do is something called a workload data importer. So you can upload data from any vendor or environment. Now, when I say this, I have to give you the warning that we may not have everything for every single CSV file type that's ever been created. We may have to massage that data a bit, but we'll help you to get that done if that's necessary. We have import policies for a lot of the vendors, so you just click, say, import it, and it gives you the information. And then we have analysis policies to help you to define different workload types. So this gives you back a free, downloadable, printable report. and it'll tell you information like, here was the read-write mix, the request size distribution, the command mix, metadata, latency versus IOPS, latency versus request size. All of that information comes back from that PCAP that you upload. An example of what that PCAP might look like, here's something where it was done for an Oracle workload. You can go back, and I added this slide in. I'll ask them to update this application, this presentation for you. So, how do you run? Let's talk about just a block-based. I'm not going to have time to get into a file-based model today. We're doing that too, but we'll talk about block for now. First, characterize the workload. You want to know per one, I/O, read-write mix, random or sequential, hotspots, hotspot drift, data content, how random it is, how compressible it is, the number of repeating blocks that are observed. Some of this you can get from that application that I just described to you. Others you have to get from the data set itself. It can be a lot of people read something in and gzip it just to see how reducible it is, as an example. You want to understand the data content patterns, how much random versus how much compressible data there was, how many unique instances of each random or compressible block there were, and then you generate a test. So we also want to understand those patterns, the streams, how they play back. This is where hotspots and hotspot drift matter. When we're playing them back, we want to make sure that it's going to look as closely as possible to that application. You then build the I/O models. You decide when you want to model this. Do you want the bootstorm? Do you want the everyday load? Do you want the backup? Do you want the end of period processing? You test all of those individually, and then you aggregate them together to understand the total workload that that application will see. You want to test periodic stuff, as I said, so end-of-month billing, what happens when a snapshot happens, what happens when there's a clone made. Oftentimes, you've got a company that's doing examples. Oh, we got a new version of the Oracle app coming up, so we make a snapshot so that the developers can test against that snapshot and not have to worry about the live data. And we want to magnify that load and each of those loads to a rainy day. What's the worst we expect to see during the life of this storage array? You run the models, as I've already talked about the different ones. You add the periodic models, combine, in many cases, because people are combining applications on a single storage array today, you should be testing everything I just talked about for multiple applications. So you're looking at those behaviors and how they intersect and interact over time. We want to understand the array features themselves. How well does MPIO work in block, for example? What is the best way to spread MPIO? Do I need 2 ports, 4 ports, 8 ports? What should I be doing there? Should I be using it as a round-robin type of implementation? Should I use least queue depth? I have some strong opinions about that, but that's testing. That's for everybody to find out, and I haven't seen every array on the planet yet. You want to understand if QoS is implemented. You want to understand how, at or near full capacity. How's it going to go when this guy is getting pretty full? Do this iteratively. You run, analyze, repeat any tests that you need to, and then tends to reflect the expected business conditions. That's what I mean by the different style of workloads that you run concurrently. So, for a vendor, you'll know what an array is going to do for an instance of an application. But you can now take that and get it. If your customer has access to your performance statistics, you can download that, run it in your own lab, and understand what that application really looked like in that environment. This can be really useful for troubleshooting, but also for design. When you're trying to build new features into an application, new models for that application, to at least be testing according to something that actually happened out in the world, not something that was synthetic. Glued together. Uptime, acceleration, new application deployment. Sorry, that's marketing. So the whole point of this, I hope you've gotten, is that testing with application models is not a nice to have. It's really, really important for vendors and for enterprises as well. What was a black art has become repeatable. We don't have a perfect workload for everybody at every second, at every time. For example, with file, we're still working on issues doing things like quotas, things that vary over time and how those change. There's a lot of chatter, for example, in the SMB protocols of the client just making sure that it's able to do stuff. But we can get the bulk of those commands and repeat that application with much more fidelity than we've ever been able to do before. With Fibre Channel, you can test data and metadata, so you can take portions of drives out of service, put them back in. Those commands exist in our applications, in our testing apps. And by doing all this, we're going to get as close as it's possible today. You want to see how close your application model emulates a real app? Customers compare this regularly with us, and we're usually within 1% to 2% of what that application did to that array during the time period that we observed. And we're able to get a more realistic view of how things are going to operate over time. And this really is changing storage testing. I'm going to repeat one more time. Burstiness is important. We'll talk about that Tuesday night. I'm sorry I didn't have more time to go into it today. But it has dramatic effects on application performance. We'll get customers that tell us, your testing app is slower than VD Bench. And we say, yeah, it is. But our application is much more closely resembling what's going to happen. Now, you don't have to use, I'm not saying you have to use virtual instruments at all, but if you're going to do stuff with using VD Bench, you better start including burstiness. Without it, you're not going to understand how an array is going to operate. So, is that it? Yeah, that's it. That's the end of what I have to rant at you. Do you have any questions for me? I guess.
So I have a question. So you told that we can upload our data to that cloud.
Yes.
And you'll get the, so like, is it a real time for the same, like we need some time after this, it will be analyzed and reportedly sent back? Like how much?
Minutes.
Minutes.
Seconds or minutes. It doesn't take long to do that analysis. What we do is we take the input from the, we read the CSV file in, we do our analysis from it, we present the data that we saw. We also automatically, the new version of this, and in our own application, it'll take that CSV file, produce that, and you can press a button, it generates the application. You're done, it's ready to test, instead of the weeks or months it can take to do a VD Bench test. So, pretty valuable stuff, I think.
So we can like use this application in timely manner, say if I want this data to be generated and it should talk to my array and gather the information over the every 7 days or something. We can use that application directly there.
Yes, it'll take, so you, the question was, I'm sorry, I should have repeated that. The question was, can you do this data, read it periodically, and then use that to generate a test and run that test? Yes, and let me make one more point. The way that we do this is through a dedicated appliance. It's not any magic hardware. It is magic software. The hardware is, you know, the usual best of the best we can get, Intel and a few other vendors, but it's very high. The reason we do that, we get the best NICs we can, we get the fastest, the processor and the number of cores that we need to give us the most consistent performance. So if the performance doesn't vary from test to test, that can be a huge problem with the free tools. Secondly, we have optimized all of this. It's our own TCP stack, it's our own protocol stack for the file side for block. We've optimized that as well. If you look at the people say, oh, what's your CPU utilization? Running a test? It's 100% all the time because we're doing an endless loop of trying to find what we need to do to make this as fast as possible, to make it as clean and possible, as repeatable as possible.
So the software which you're preparing is more for the clients or more for the vendors? It's more to simulate the, somehow calculate what would be the performance of your application from client perspective, or for vendors to test the, so the disk, or this somehow can combine both of these?
I don't mean to be rude, but yes. We started out selling to vendors. And that's why the protocol implementation is as deep as we've done. So we started selling only to vendors. When we, a few years in, we started to talk to enterprises. And they wanted to be they wanted kind of the same information. The vendors wanted, I want the Oracle workload. The customer wants my Oracle workload. So we started to sell to them, and they were always asking us, workloads, 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 workloads. You got workloads, you got workloads. And it was not an easy thing to generate. That's why we spent a lot of time and money now to be able to take that in, get it from a realistic environment. We can either do this, those CSV files. I didn't mention the other side, which is a probe-based implementation where you tap into a network, and we see every packet, every frame that goes by on the wire, and we aggregate statistics out of that. We're early in the development of that product. We're just about to come out with our first products for that. But that's the ultimate way to understand how an application goes. You get very detailed statistics. We don't collect payloads. We don't want payloads. We don't collect passwords. We don't collect, you know, all of that stuff that can be worrisome to any enterprise or especially finance-based enterprises. We don't want to know that. What we want to know is what happened to that application. How did it run? We can come back, and if we need them, we can add in usernames, passwords. We can come back later or working with that customer to understand how deduplicatable, how compressible it was. And we'll get more of that over time. But the idea is for the vendors, test before while they're building. For the end users, test before they buy, test before they change configuration, test before they do any sort of an upgrade. This is a regular thing. And vendors say, or enterprises say, oh, we don't have a lab. Sure they do. They test in production every day. That can be very painful. And if by some reason our company could save 20% a year on the storage purchasing costs, it more than pays for that lab. I'm sorry, I'm being a bit vendor talky here. And I just got the hook. So I'll still be around. Please come and talk to me if you'd like to. I'll be glad to talk to you. Any of you that are attending the PlugFest, we'll be downstairs all week and we'll spend time with you happily there. If not, Monday night, tomorrow night, there's an open house in the PlugFest and you can see some of the stuff I've been talking about. Thank you for your time. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you have questions about the material presented in this podcast, be sure and join our developers mailing list by sending an email to developers-subscribe@snea.org. Here you can ask questions and discuss this topic further with your peers in the developer community. For additional information about the Storage Developer Conference, visit storagedeveloper.org.